So the idea of today's tutorial is to continue what Ricardo introduced as some basic formulas, especially having in mind, sorry, I will take at the moment this up just so that if you want to see the what's written on the both blackboards. So Ricardo has gone through a few basic ideas from resurgence, transseries, Borel transforms, asymptotic behavior. So one of the things that the example that he used basically in his talk throughout was the quartic integral, which I've written here some of the basic formulas, which actually Ricardo mentioned during his talk. It's just here as you can come and see the different formulas all together in case you need to remind yourself of something. In any case, you have the quartic integral described by this integral with a potential which has a quadratic piece and a quartic piece, and there's the coupling x. So you can actually determine meaning some asymptotic solutions from the fact that this integral obeys a certain differential equation. You can plug in an ansatz to this differential equation and you find two independent solutions. You can write the most general solution up to two integration constants that are basically boundary conditions, and the general solution is the transseries. And then Ricardo also mentioned that you could define the Borel transforms, and if you want to remember what the Borel transform does, it does an inverse Laplace transform to each element of the series in that way. So you can actually, because you know all of these elements in closed form, in this particular case, you can actually determine the Borel transforms in closed form and analyze them. And also another thing that he's mentioned was the Stokes automorphism. So how do you encode Stokes phenomena was through this operator called the Stokes automorphism, which he also mentioned it was related to an alien derivation at the time. I don't know if you remember. I'm not going to go into the details of this, but it's just that actually the Stokes automorphism encodes how to jump across these singular lines that have the lines that have similarities in the Borel transforms. And I've written here the two non-trivial Stokes automorphisms, which are for phi 0 and phi 1. It's two lines. Basically, I've written here that the Stokes lines, you can actually check where the Stokes lines, we're going to speak about this more carefully, are at 0 and pi. So the Stokes automorphisms are at 0 and pi, and you can determine the non-trivial Stokes automorphisms. Ricardo actually mentioned this the last time. So this is just a gathering of a lot of formulas. You probably don't remember how he got here, but we are actually going to see some separate parts of this more slowly. This is just to have all of the formulas available at all times, whenever you want to see. I will also mention the Airy function example. The reason why is because it's very, very similar to the quartic integral. The reason is that if you want to actually go into Mathematica and compare any of your approximations and results, you have, Airy AI of K, kappa, in Mathematica, you can compare to the exact solution right away. So you don't even, you can compare how all the plots that I'm going to show you, you can do them as well. So I will use for some of the things just the Airy function, just because it's a very easy example that you can just play around right away. So let me just say, okay, so Ricardo mentioned how to determine the Borel transforms. It was according to this rule, which is basically an inverse Laplace transform to each element of our series. That means that how do we go back to the original solution? You do a Laplace transform. But you do a Laplace transform, meaning if you put a series here, of course, you'll get a series here, meaning a asymptotic series here. That's not our point. If we can have either the exact form here for the Borel transforms or an approximation, a functional approximation of our Borel transform, we can get a functional approximation of our solution, which is a resummed solution here. So other things is that the Stokes automorphisms actually, meaning when you have singular directions, which are the Stokes lines, the Stokes automorphism is defined exactly by the difference between the summation above and below this Stokes line. A different definition that I will use just for convenience is what's called the discontinuity. It's basically just the Stokes automorphism. It's just removing. If you look at how the Stokes automorphism looks, it always has the function itself plus something. It's the plus something that we're interested in, and that's the part that we're removing right here. So this is just rewriting the first formula. So again, just mentioning what Ricardo mentioned previously, because it's a Stokes automorphism, it actually defines a derivation, which is called the alien derivation. And of course, the Stokes automorphism encodes all the Stokes phenomena. So this is just a gathering, a very quick gathering of what happened in the previous tutorial. Again, all those formulas seem a lot, but they're just in case you want to find the relevant expansions and the numbers and all of these things. The rest doesn't matter. At the moment, the first step that I'm going to take is actually from the quartic integral point of view, I am going to define the steepest descent contours. So I have my partition function as defined, as written there. This is the potential. Okay, I hope that the screen gets turned on by me moving my computer, otherwise it's going to be interesting. Okay, yeah, good. So how do you do saddle point analysis? You calculate first the saddle points of the potential. There's the point zero and two points which are symmetric and will contribute always in the same way. In fact, if you look at the differential equation, it's a second order linear differential equation, so it will be only two independent solutions, in fact. This is due to the fact that the quartic potential is symmetric. So for each one of the saddle points, what are the leading contributions to this integral? Well, are the values of the potential in this at this point. And you could think, okay, what? You could think, okay, because here it shows up as exponential of minus v, you think, ah, these are exponentially suppressed, and this is leading because it's perturbative. But actually, if you think in the complex plane of x, this depends on the argument of x, which one of the saddles will be leading. And actually, the saddle point analysis, sorry, the steepest descent contours will give us a way of determining which saddle is leading or not. So how do I define my steepest descent contours? I find my steepest descent contours by a contour that passes on a specific saddle. I choose one saddle. And I define the contour that whose imaginary part is constant throughout. So whatever the imaginary part in my saddle is the same as the imaginary part everywhere else. And these are the contours that actually go to infinity when z goes to infinity. Why? Because I want them to actually decrease as much as possible at infinity. So this defines me a steepest descent contour. And the natural question for all of these Stokes phenomena is, so does a single steepest descent contour pass always through a single saddle? And how do we determine which contributions are leading and subleading? And this now. Now we go back to... this. Okay. And the first slide that I want to show you, this can be done in Mathematica. You can ask for a contour plot that obeys these conditions. And you can actually plot them. Sorry. How do I move slides? Well, I can just do this and do this. So this, okay, now I need to really increase the size of the screen. So these are the old, so I'm changing basically the argument of x while keeping the modulus of x constant and equals to 1. And what do I get? Well, let me not start right away with the theta equals 0, just because, as I mentioned, actually it's a Stokes line. But let me choose just after zero, very close to zero, but just after zero. You can see that, so what's plotted here in brown and in blue is the when the potential is greater than the value of the potential at zero, so which is zero. And when in blue, it's when it's less than that. Which means that if the saddles fall on a brown area here, that means that they're subleading compared to the middle one. And the other way around. If they fall on the C, they will be leading compared to this one, because they will be less exponentially suppressed compared to the leading one. I could do exactly the same plot with potential leveled at the two other saddles. But it's an equivalent plot. In any case, so these are the steepest descent contours. I have a leading steepest descent contour here in black, passing the perturbative line, and I have subleading ones. Also, the steepest descent contours that you see are the ones that always end up in the inland, so in the brown area. Why? Because I want them to go to infinity, to plus infinity. So, in any case, so I have two subleading saddles, one leading saddle, but the contours don't pass through two saddles. It's very natural. I keep on changing, rotating the value of the k, the value of theta, which is the argument of x. So here, they're still the same plot. And here, something strange happens. So at pi over 2 exactly, all the saddles are actually at the exact same level. So they're at the shore level. So that means that all the saddles, if I included all the saddles in my solution, saddles will be of the same exact order. So before this, all the two saddles were subleading. So if I had in some way ignored them, I would have some exponential error, but it would be okay. But at this point, the solution will not be complete without these two saddles. So this tells me that I should have included in some way the two saddles before, because what's going to happen after this point? It's going to happen that they swap the leading contribution, and now the saddles that are leading are the two saddles, the two exponential saddles, and the perturbative saddle, the original perturbative saddle, becomes subleading. These lines where the all the saddles contribute at the same with the same meaning they're all leading, there's no subleading saddles, are the anti-Stokes lines. These are lines where basically because the real part of the saddles is all the same, you'll have that the imaginary part will give some kind of oscillatory behavior in the solution. You can see easily this in the Airy function at the kappa equals pi, which is an anti-Stokes line where there's an oscillatory behavior because there's two solutions competing. So we can keep on going. And so here, again, these are leading, and the perturbative saddle is subleading. And now here in pi, something different happens. So the two outside saddles are still leading. The middle one is still subleading. But the contours now, if you see, any contour that I choose will pass through more than one saddle. So the steepest descent contours before would always avoid the other saddles. And here, they suddenly pass through more than one saddle. This is the point where, this is where the Stokes phenomena happens, actually. So, sorry. This is where the Stokes lines are. So you have the saddles. So you have, imagine that you had started with just the perturbative series by any chance. And then now you keep on going. Well, actually, this is not, this point is not. Imagine that you had started with this leading saddles and you didn't have the subleading contribution. At this point, suddenly, you pick up this saddle, because you can see that now the contour, the steepest descent contour instead that would go like this, now goes like this, which actually, in terms of the previous ones, it's a sum of this contour with this contour. So basically, what happens in the Stokes lines in terms of the steepest descent contour is that after the Stokes line, the saddles that you hadn't chosen to include in your solution get picked up by the steepest descent contours, and you need to include them. So I said that I didn't want to start at theta equals zero just because this is also a Stokes line. It's a zero and pi are Stokes lines, and this is exactly what happens. Just before theta equals zero, I have my perturbative solution, which is leading, and then at the Stokes line, suddenly the perturbative solution, the steepest descent contour passes through all the saddles, and here I need to include them, such that while I, if I continue rotating in the complex plane, at this point I've included all the saddles and I have my oscillatory behavior that is typical in the anti-Stokes lines. So this is just a general idea of how to see the Stokes phenomena from the point of view of the steepest descent contours. But
I'm confused a little about why you call it this, the steepest descent. Because I always thought of steepest descent as following the gradient.
Of the potential.
Yeah. Whereas here, it's just the imaginary part.
Or she really.
Is she the same?
Yeah, it's the same.
Yeah.
And the number of dimensions, do you mean?
The number of dimensions to be?
I mean, keeping constant the imaginary part could be not enough.
Yeah, but this is just a single integral. This is the simplest case. You need to for multi-dimensional integrals, you need a generalization, naturally.
For holomorphic functions.
So. But now. This was just an idea of how to do this from the steepest descent, but the idea is actually to not go through the steepest descent contours, but go directly to the... to go directly from this kind of formalism to the to the Stokes phenomena. So, the question then is, how can I capture this behavior from the transferist point of view? How can I see it? So, basically the Stokes phenomenon, what we saw from the point of view of the steepest descent contour is that you can see that you have basically different values of the argument of K will have different asymptotic leading contributions coming from different saddles. How can we see that from the point of view of writing a general trans series, like I've written there, like that I have two solutions for the quartic integral, and basically it's like how does capture the Stokes phenomena in a trans series? How can we see these different asymptotic behaviors? And how do we check that a trans series is resurgent? And what I mean it's resurgent, I mean that So that there's asymptotic behavior that is governed by this Stokes automorphism, and that I can actually apply to the trans series and get all of the information of the Stokes phenomena. And the other question is, how do we actually, so I have a trans series, how do I evaluate the trans series? And just the key words to how we're going to do this is that this we will do from analysis of asymptotics and from the large order relations, and this we will do by summation methods, which I will show different options of summation methods and how accurate they actually are. So, I need to go back and put it down. I go back to the quartic integral again, and what I want to do is to plot my z and zeros. I know that my two solutions, phi 0 and phi 1, from the point of view of the differential equation, which is the easiest way, meaning it's a linear ODE, we can analyze it very well. I have these two series, phi 0 and phi 1, which are asymptotic series solutions of this differential equation for x very small. And I have these coefficients, which I want to analyze their behavior. So I have the z and zeros, which are the coefficients of one of the solutions, phi 0. It's the perturbative solution. And I want to see, does it diverge factorially? Can I take any information out of this divergence? And can I see that numerically? And the way to do that, So the first part of this Mathematica file is just definitions. I'm writing the meaning. I know that there's one solution of the instanton action of the quartic integral which is zero. There's another one which is 3/2. I write just that A is 3/2. I write the z0 and the z1, which are the coefficients for phi 0 and phi 1. I've written there the Borel transforms for phi 0 and phi 1, which are the two expressions that I have here. And this I will tell you in a moment what it is, but it's part of definitions. It's Richardson transforms. But I will not right away tell you. I will tell you when we actually use it. So the first thing we do is let's plot the z0s. What happens if I plot the z0ns? I get a behavior that is definitely diverging really, really fast. Meaning you have that z01 is of order 1, and you have now z0. 40 and 50 are already 10 to the 41. So this is not a good way of checking anything, of seeing anything. So, okay, because I know that it should have some sort of factorial growth, the best way to actually deal with this is by dividing n plus 1 divided by n. So if I assume that the z0, zn's go as a... So then maybe I go here. So if I assume that the z0n's go as gamma for n plus beta factorial, and now let me assume that it has a subleading exponential growth, which is given by A. What happens if I do the zn plus 1 divided by zn? Well, this basically goes, it's very easy to tell, that this goes as n over A plus order 1. Typically, actually, this is not the only thing. There will be some constant term, and then can be a series in N as well associated to this. But in particular, the leading term will be basically linear in N. So what I've plotted here is not it's not Zn plus 1 divided by Zn, but I divided by N already. And if I do this, it's very easy now to see. So this is the blue line here. And now I will tell you what the Richardson transform is. So the blue line is coming close to this value. And what I plotted there as a line is 1 over A, which is what I can expect this. So if I multiply here by 1 over N, this should go as 2 1 over A. And I can see that there is definitely a convergence. But can I improve this convergence? Meaning, okay, I can see that there is a convergence, but it's not very accurate. The way to actually do this more accurately in these cases, when you have a sequence that it's like, basically, if I have a sequence that it's S0 plus S1 over N plus S2 over N squared plus etc., like this, I can actually check the convergence of this sequence to the original S0, for example. Sorry, this it goes, it's approximately that, but not many, it's not exactly. by the Richardson transforms. So the Richardson transforms for the S. Sorry, let me actually here use K, because here I used K. The Richardson transform of order N has a definition, basically. This is a closed form definition, but I will tell you exactly what it does. K plus N to the N divided by N factorial, N minus N factorial, N minus N, S of K plus N. So it's very easy. Try this for N equals 1 and expand this for large K. So I'm taking that this is true for large K. So for large K, if I take this sum and expand it for large K, what I will see is that I will get S0, and then all the other terms in the series cancel until order of K to the minus N plus 1. It's very easy. The easiest thing to do is actually to try with N equals 1. It's only two terms. You can expand, and you can see that the order S1 term cancels, and you have higher orders than that expands. So that means that if I plot instead of my original series that converges to this, the Richardson sort of transform of this series of order N, that means that the convergence to the S0 is going to be much faster because the rest, the tail, is much, much, much smaller. And this is exactly what you see. This is order Richardson transform of order 1. This is Richardson transform of order 3, N equals 3. This is just a mathematical tool to see the convergence definitely much faster. Now I got the convergence to my constant here, my leading behavior, so like kind of yes, the 1 over A. But there are other contributions. For example, in particular, there could be a beta here divided by N. By A N. So can I see this subleading behavior, actually? Because I've already known the first, but I would like to know more and more subleading behaviors. And in fact, it's very easy to do it. You actually subtract this part. So you do the Zn plus 1 divided by Zn minus times N minus 1 over A. You multiply, this is not A to the N, sorry, this is times N. You multiply by N, and then this should go to beta, plus higher orders 1 over N. Again, you can use Richardson transforms and check this. I will just, a moment. So here I wrote N squared, but let me for the moment just do exactly what I've written there, which is N. And what you can see is that it's converging to 0. Very fast. This basically means that my beta is 0. So the leading order is actually not N, not beta over N, but it will be the next one, which will be beta over N squared. And I can easily see this by now multiplying by N squared, the term is 1, and I can see now it converges to some constant value. What can I use these large order relations, this large order behavior for? I can actually use this to calculate these coefficients, this C0, C1, C2, and then on, and calculate them with a fair amount of accuracy, actually. But, meaning, at the moment, they're just numbers. Can we actually learn something more about these numbers, other than being able to calculate them and have some idea of what's the asymptotics for? And here is where the Borel transform, this is where resurgence really comes about. Right now, let me stop with the asymptotics. I showed you that I have a tool of calculating higher and higher orders in this behavior, in this factorial behavior, and subleading exponential behavior of my asymptotic series. And I can, in principle, numerically calculate all of these coefficients. But where does this behavior come from? And I would like you to now take advantage of the fact that we have the Borel transforms in closed form. I know the exact solution. I know this coefficient in closed form. I can calculate the Borel transform, and I can analyze it. And one thing that I would like to tell you, so the Borel transform, this Borel transform here of the phi zero, I'm just doing phi zero, has a log cut starting at 3/2 from this hypergeometric function. So let me try and expand the Borel transform at the singular point. So what I'm doing is I'm calculating the series of, I'm multiplying by 2 pi I, just for convenience. 2 pi I, B of Z0, Borel transform of Z0 at the singular point A. And I'm calculating to two orders. And I can see that there's a pole. And then I can see a lot of behavior that is holomorphic, if there's nothing. And then I can see log cuts appearing here with a constant. Now there's another log cut again appearing at it's S minus 3/2, if you want, times S minus 3/2. And then I have yet another log cut with S minus 3/2 squared. And I just stopped here the series, but I would have a whole string of these logs. What are these terms multiplying the log that is appearing in the Borel transform of phi zero? So let me now do another thing. Let me grab the Borel transform of phi one. So I know that I have two solutions, right? Two asymptotic solutions, phi zero and phi one. I just expanded phi zero in its singular point. And now I'm doing the Borel transform of phi one of evaluated at S minus A, in S minus A, evaluated at A. This means that I'm actually calculating the phi one, the Borel transform of phi one at zero. The Borel transform as finite radius of convergence is completely well defined at zero. It has a Taylor series, and that's the series that I'm calculating. And here you have I divided by 4 square root of 2, S minus 3/2. So this is a Taylor series at S minus 3/2. And so here, what I did is, okay, I've just grabbed the numbers that were here. So 3i divided by 12 square root of 2, minus 210i divided by 1152 square root of 2, and then here the 3465, so... And I just simplified them. This is just because mathematics is putting many things together. And what you can see here, let me just first say these ones. You can see I divided by 4 square root of 2, minus 35 divided by 92 square root of 2. It's the coefficient of the Borel transform of 1. Again, this term is this coefficient where here. And you could continue. What does this mean? What actually am I calculating? What am I seeing here? What I'm seeing is something that Ricardo already mentioned the previous lecture, which is that the Borel transform phi zero evaluated at A has a pole. So, and let me write. Let me write it here like this. So actually it's a... So let me put the 2 pi I here. That's why I multiplied. Borel transform of phi 1 evaluated at S minus A times a log of S minus A times a 2. So what I plotted there, the second line is 2 times the Borel transform of phi 1 at 0 and S minus A, but evaluated at A. Here is the pole, which actually is the coefficient. That's why I've written here 2 times the Z10. It's the first coefficient, and it actually gives you the first coefficient here. And this says that the Borel transform of phi 0 in its around its singularity is directly linked to the Borel transform of phi 1 in the most regular point there is, which is 0. So there's this relation, and because we have an exact form of the Borel transform, you can see that this is, by expanding this, you can see this directly.
So What you're remarking on here is just a pretty well-known property of hypergeometric equations, right?
But sure.
Are you saying it's something more than that?
Yes. So resurgent transseries always have this type of properties. And this is actually where the fact that when you're saying that the one instanton series is encoded in the perturbative series, this is why, because the Borel transform of the one instanton series appears. So in general, when you have Borel transforms of higher instantons, imagine that you have your perturbative series and you evaluate at the n instanton series. Let's assume. And that means that what you're going to have here is the Borel transform of, meaning if you could calculate the perturbative series around the n instanton sector, this would be the Borel transform of the n instanton sector times a log cut. So, and this is not because they're hypergeometric functions. Many times you can't even calculate it in closed form. This is the hypergeometric functions is just because these are very trivial examples. But yes, so this is a general feature. And this just, you can just play with it and see this in numbers. So, okay. What if we did, that's the point. What if we didn't know the exact form, which were hypergeometric functions? What we can do, let's assume that I only have n terms of my Borel transform, of my original series. I want to approximate my series by a function, and what I do is like I will actually use the method of Padé approximants. The method of Padé approximants just approximates my series by a ratio of two polynomials, and in particular I'm using the diagonal form, which means that the two polynomials are of the same order. And what do I do? Well, I'm interested in where the singularities of my Borel transform are to understand where these relations exist. If I didn't know, because here I do know, of course, I know where the log cut is, it's very easy. But if I didn't know, I could just then take the denominator of my Padé approximant, plot it, and what would I see? I would see basically a set of poles, because it's a polynomial in the denominator, of course. But I see that the set of poles, sorry, this is a bit small, but they condense, and in this red dot, this is actually the value 3/2. So I have a log cut, basically, or a cut. At the moment, I couldn't tell from here that it was a log cut, naturally. But a cut starting at the point 3/2. And you can do this generally, again, with any instanton series.
Sorry, is there a principled reason why the Padé approximation is a good idea?
Works is the main reason. No, you'd think that there's actually... Well, it's known that there are better... approximations for different things, and you should, in particular here, if you could approximate with something that would, you know, mimic some log cuts, would probably give you even better approximations. The problem is that the interesting thing is that Padé approximant gives you extremely good results, and it's easy to use, and so in that sense, in most problems, it's enough, is the answer. So, okay, this we, now we stop a moment, and we continue now with the, so what we did before, if we didn't know what the Borel transforms were, we could definitely determine the singular points of the Borel transforms, at least the leading singular points, but, how do we know that they're resurgent transseries? Meaning I could calculate these relations because I had the closed form expression. But what if I don't have the closed form expression? There are ways of seeing these relations without knowing the closed form expression. And this, I will show this in a moment. Let me just... So what we do is the so-called large order relations. And this, actually, for these, the Stokes automorphism is essential. So basically, what you need for these, the ingredients that you need for this, is the trend series with some coefficients of the phi ends. You need to know that it's resurgent, or assume that it's resurgent, determine the large order relations and check if it's resurgence. And you can get these large order relations. So how do I do this? Well, imagine that I have, in the complex plane, I have a point x, and I make a contour around x, like this. Cauchy theorem tells me, very easily, that I can write around the point x, f of omega, I mean, this is a statement that it's very simple. X is not a special point, there's nothing there. Now, assume that you have some Stokes lines. So these are my Stokes lines. So they're lines where the Borel transform is going to have singularities, cuts, branch points. And what I do now is I deform this contour to infinity. When I have these singular directions, I go around them. Whatever. So I go around them, and what I get is contours like this around my singular directions. This is S plus, S minus, S plus, S minus, S plus minus S minus, S plus minus S minus of a direction theta. What is S plus minus S minus? It's just a discontinuity that I've written before at the beginning, which is given directly by the Stokes automorphism. So, what I mean is that, so I know that S plus minus S minus equals to minus S minus of the discontinuity. So this is theta plus, theta minus. The reason why I'm doing theta minus or theta plus is because the discontinuity itself can have also singularity, so you need to define a particular contour where you're analyzing the discontinuity. So this, from Cauchy theorem, then I can write as 1 over 2 pi I, sum in my theta directions, the singular directions, integral of e to the I theta infinity, d omega, discontinuity along theta of f divided by omega minus x. So this is an L evaluated in omega. So I have a sum over the discontinuities, which are basically these contours. I'm neglecting the contribution at infinity, which in basically from physical arguments, typically you can assume, you can state that it's zero. So it won't contribute the circle at infinity, only these discontinuities will contribute. But what can I do with this formula? I have series, I don't have my functions, I have a series. So let me say that my f of x is phi zero of x. So it's the perturbative series. And I have some terms of the perturbative series, I don't know how many, meaning there I have the closed form, but I have some terms of the perturbative series. What I will end up getting, so in this equation, what I have from here is sum of n equals 0 to infinity, zn 0, x to the n, that's the phi 0 here. And here, now it's when it's important to know that the Stokes automorphism, so when I wrote the Stokes automorphism there at 0, is equal of phi 0 is equal to phi 0 minus 2 e to the minus 3 over 2x phi 1. So I'm just rewriting the formula that is there. So the discontinuity, because it's 1 minus, so then 1 minus the Stokes automorphism at 0 acting on phi 0, it's just 2 e to the minus 3 half 2 of x, phi, so phi 1. And this is the discontinuity that appears here. So this f and this f are the same f. So now this is the sum, and here I write minus 1 over 2 phi I. So phi 0 only, how many Stokes lines does phi 0 have? Only has one, the direction 0. It only has one singular direction. So this sum in theta is just theta equals 0. So I have 0 to infinity d omega discontinuity at 0 phi 0 divided by omega minus x. That is given by this. And I can just now substitute this here, and I get that this is equal to minus 1 over 2 pi I integral in d omega 0 to infinity plus 2 divided by omega minus x omega. Oops, let me write it k here. So I just rewrote the Cauchy's theorem in terms of the discontinuity. The discontinuity is related to the Stokes automorphism, gives me the jump across this singular direction. And now I can just, I have a series on this side and a series on this side. This series depends on x here, this series depends on x. What will I do next? Well, I need to actually expand for x small. And this is basically sum h equals to 0 to infinity of x to the h divided by omega to the h plus 1. And another thing that I need is the integration from 0 to infinity d omega e minus a over omega, omega w minus. So this integration, which is equals to gamma of alpha divided by a to the alpha, if alpha is greater than 0 and a greater than 0. I'm assuming they're real. So again, for any function f, I use the Cauchy theorem. I rewrote the f. I changed the contour and kept the discontinuities of f, which I know are in the Stokes directions. I then write the discontinuity from the Stokes automorphism, which I can calculate from resurgence, and then plug in the series. And this, if I now compare equal powers of x, I can try and calculate what the Zn's are. If you actually look a little bit closer, of course, this, when I plug this into this expression and I try to compare equal powers of x, meaning this integral only converges in these cases. But there will be always, you're going to see if you do this carefully, there will always going to be powers of omega which will not obey this condition. Because there will be powers of omega coming from the phi 1 and there will be powers of omega coming from here. So basically, what happens is that you have a formal relation that you get. This is not. Which basically gives you that Zn0 is approximately minus 2 over 2 pi I gamma of n divided by a to the n sum k. Let me write in this way. what I did is actually take out the leading factorial growth, the subleading exponential growth, which I got directly from Cauchy theorem and the Stokes automorphism, just plugging them in. And now I have this series in, if you look at this, it's a series in 1 over n. This is only valid, of course, if I'm assuming n very, very large. Because, of course, there would be a point at which in this sum that the k would be greater than n or something like that, because I'm summing in k. But I'm assuming n very, very large, so this is a large order relation. And what I get is the growth that I already saw from the z's and the fact that the subleading parts in 1 over n, so just notice that this is just, this part here is just z01 plus z11a divided by n minus 1 plus z22a squared divided by n minus 1 times n minus 2, etc. And this, if I expand for large n, is just z01 plus z11a over n plus a z11 plus a squared z21. So it's not 2, 2, 1 divided by n squared plus etc. So I have that the large order of the zn's have this growth and then subleading terms that are related to the one instanton series. Remember that we saw this relation between the Borel transforms, that the phi 0 of the Borel transform of phi 0 had encoded the Borel transform of phi 1. This is another way of saying this, that the zn zeros have encoded the zn ones. And remember that I was saying at the beginning when I was doing the asymptotics of the zn's that I could calculate term by term an expansion in 1 over n in principle, but I didn't know what those numbers meant. I know now what those numbers mean. Those numbers mean exactly these z's. So basically those numbers are the z's here. Actually this is not, meaning in general here, what is not written here is that this number here is not a trivial thing to calculate. In most cases, it's a Stokes constant. And this is one of the biggest issues in terms.
So I think this calculation has a more intuitive interpretation in Borel plane, in which you are interested in the asymptotics of the Taylor coefficients at zero function, which is analytic with singularities. And this is the known duality between the asymptotics of Taylor coefficients and the Puiseux series at the nearest
singularity. Yep.
So this is what you said.
So what I can show you this now is exactly what I'm doing. Now I'm calculating the z0's n's, the coefficient zn's. I'm multiplying by 2 pi, not by a di, because it's more difficult, but by 2 pi a to the n divided by gamma to the n. So I'm basically multiplying by this factor so that I can directly see the z's appearing. And then I plotted the series and the Richardson transforms, as I've mentioned, and I plot here the line that I predicted it would lead to. And you can see for the Richardson transforms that they really fall in line. Can I go subleading the same way as I've done before? Of course I can go subleading. So now I remove the first term here, and I multiply by n. I plot it again, do the Richardson transforms. This is the value, so it's the z11 that it should go to. It's plotted by the line, and you can again see that it converges. So now I'm just checking that my convergences go to the correct values. But I could have done the before, the idea was before I could have done this asymptotic analysis and I was calculating these ones term by term. So basically I can either check, like I'm doing now, or I can use it to actually predict the values of the one instanton series. So this at the moment concludes the part of the large order relations. We go now to the summation. So this is how to check that something is resurgent, what the resurgent relations actually come from. You can do this analysis is very It's extremely similar in the nonlinear cases. Instead of having, you know, the discontinuity here of the phi 0 had just phi 1, typically it'll have phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, and more and more exponentially suppressed. But the question still remains, I have a trans series, how do I evaluate it? How do I give a number to each one of these asymptotic series? And that I haven't yet dealt with. And there's a few ways of there's a few ways of dealing with this.
From the argument that the gentleman in the front row mentioned suggests that any series that you apply this to, this would actually work?
Any resurgence series, meaning so imagine that you have asymptotics and you know there's instantons. You can actually analyze, meaning you have your trans series solution, which is basically adding the perturbative series and then in a particular way the instanton corrections as well. And with that, if you don't know that it's resurgent and you want to check, you say, okay, let me assume that this trans series is resurgent. And from that, you can actually directly, using the alien derivations, you can calculate the Stokes automorphism, assuming that it is. And then from that, meaning from this Cauchy theorem, you get directly the Dislagrange relations. And so if this goes wrong really fast.
I mean, this much doesn't really depend on resurgence. I mean, if you have in Borel plane a function which is analytic in the unit disk with a sort of a finite number of singularities on the unit circle, the whole thing goes through.
Yes. But the fact that there's these relations, these non-trivial relations that keep on relating phi 0 to phi 1, phi 1 to phi 2, phi 2 to phi 3 is
yeah, but this large order.
The large order relations you can calculate, yes. But so you can predict, you can get some large order relations, and what happens is that actually if you plug in the numbers and some assumption in your in what you've done is wrong, and in particular the typical thing, if you have asymptotics, if you have instantons, it's almost guaranteed, not always, but it's very likely that you have resurgence.
But I mean, is there an example where resurgence fails? Because I mean, this argument seems to say that you would find some large order relations, so you find some resurgent series from any series, and there's a question of, did you really mean to be studying a different series that didn't have these large order relations, or?
Sorry, I didn't understand. I thought
that the argument you presented says that in the Borel plane, there's just some singularity at some distance, and so the rate of convergence of the Borel series is set by sort of the nearest singularity, and then you get some relation between the series associated with that singularity and the original series. So I thought that was sort of a justification for the large order relations. So then, doesn't every series have some set of large order relations?
Yes, but if you don't have resurgence, the large order relations basically collapse into some things that are very simple. Meaning if you have just poles, for example, meaning these large order relations will become very, very simple objects. Basically, instead of having a whole series attached to this, you'll have a finite Taylor series. Because all these series that I've written here, this series here, is actually asymptotic as well, in N. So if you had a pole instead of actually a cut, which makes this relation between phi 0 and phi 1, this series would just basically truncate at some point, or have finite rates of convergence.
I mean, what you did there would hold, I mean, even in a physical domain, if you take the Laplace transform of a function which has sort of finite humidity singularity or something like this, some standard assumption.
But the fact that you see these relations between the perturbative series and the higher instanton series is something of resurgence.
Less than resurgence. It's strictly less, much less than resurgence.
It's much less. No, these relations are resurgence.
We can discuss it.
Is there a definition of resurgence that is...
Well, there are definitions and mathematical definitions of resurgent functions, but I would say that in most cases that we've studied, we don't even know that if those definitions apply, because you only have a series. And by just having the series in themselves, you don't have many times the way of checking checking whether it falls into the Givray 1 type of functions, for example.
So what is hiding on trivia is the relation between the Laurel series of the instantons and the main series. So these are sort of strong resurgent relations. I mean, that's this much the asymptotic behavior just follows from Cauchy's theorem in Laurel plane and deformation of power.
No, but you've used the Stokes, you've used this, and this is where resurgence is. So you've used this in those large order relations.
Excuse me, I don't quite understand your calculation, because you assume that if your function f is an entire function, no singularities, right? It's a whole complex plane. In order to deform the contour, you need to assume that f doesn't have any singularities, right?
Meaning you have to deform the contour around the singularities.
No. You write the Cauchy theorem and then deform the contours and move the contour in such a way. So
there are no other singularities, yes. I'm assuming that there are no other singularities.
No other singularities. No, it's entire functions.
No other singularities? No. These are whole singular. In here, there's a whole string of singularities.
But are they singularities of f function or the one that...
So they're in fact...
Then you derive the resurgence relations, right?
Yes.
But if there's some, let's say, not just isolated singularities, that it will block the resurgence.
No, it will just not be part of these large order relations.
The argument sort of goes through even if you have singularities, because it's about large order behavior.
Because then you just have a kind of a...
And you just truncate you stop the contour short of reaching the singularities. I mean, if you have enough...
No, but even if you had singularities, you could add to these relations like a contour around singularities, use residue theorem.
You should know the analytical structure of the whole functions, you know, there's some information which is very difficult to...
But that's the exact point. What you know from these functions, you know the singular behavior of the Borel transform. You can actually determine from that the singular directions that you need to go around. So that's the information that you take from the Borel plane. You take the singular directions that you have to go around, and these are the ones that I counted. It can be many, many. It can be infinite numbers of these singular directions.
So one way to think of those discontinuities are discontinuities of the asymptotic approximation to the function, which means that not everywhere on the Borel plane you're going to have the very same asymptotic approximation. The function can even be, you know, very well behaved and without many singularities, but yet the asymptotic approximation will differ. And those are the discontinuities you should have in mind.
Well, in other words, these are not true discontinuities of the function, but they are quote-unquote discontinuities of the asymptotic representation.
Of the series itself, yes.
I mean, maybe they shouldn't be called discontinuities. It's a Stokes jump. No.
So sure, they're Stokes lines. You're calculating like some a jump across a Stokes line.
Like 280, for instance, which is an entire function.
Yeah. But the actual series that you calculate, if you do the asymptotics, they're asymptotic series, and they will have these things. So the actual entire function will be defined by the sum of these two series, in particular ways. So. Now, like I said, I was saying, evaluating the series, so... So, summation. I can go... Typically, if you have an asymptotic series, the easiest thing to do, for example, is taking optimal truncation. So if I do optimal truncation, I truncate at the, I keep all the terms, so I have a series that it's an x to the n plus 1, let me assume at the moment like this, where an goes as n factorial for n larger than 1. And I keep all the terms such that an divided by an minus 1 is of order of my x, such that, like, at that point, basically the series is still decreasing instead of starting to increase. I calculate the value, the n optimal, such that all the terms before that still obey this, and basically I can then sum. So if I have this phi of x, so I can write the phi optimal of x, which is equal to sum n equals 0 to n optimal. And the n optimal, of course, will depend on x, on the value of x here, of a n x to the minus n, sorry, n to the n plus 1. So the error of this naturally will be exponentially suppressed with the instanton action. So you can do this, and you can also do the what Ricardo mentioned already. I don't know which order, for a Padé resummation. Where I define the Laplace transform, and let me write it here. Sorry, Laplace transform, yeah, let me write 0 e to the I theta infinity. I'm assuming that this one doesn't have, this direction is not a singular direction. Ds e minus s over x. The Borel transform of phi s. But, in fact, I usually don't know the Borel transform exactly. So let me, instead of writing this, I write Borel Padé of order n, assuming that I have n terms. And I'm going to call this, this should be phi of x. The resummation at order n. So for each value of x, I can do this integral. I have the approximation of my Borel transform by Padé methods, and I can calculate this resummation. So this is Ecole Borel Padé. And now, for example, one question that we want to ask is, how does this compare, these two compare? Another question that that I want to ask is, can I take x to be, can I change the value of mod x, can I change the value of mod theta, and still obtain, you know, analytic continuations of my solutions with these summations for different values of mod of x? Another thing that I haven't mentioned here, this can be done for any asymptotic series, but how does it compare if I try to do instead, I could do it for phi 0, or for, actually let's now just because, like I mentioned, to compare with the exact values of the Airy function, I will use the Airy function. I can do for z of a at I, I can do the optimal truncation, I can do this for the z of a at I, or I can actually do for the actual trend series. So I've written the total solution for the, in particular for the so when I write z theta of n of the trend series, I mean that I'm going to take some particular value of sigma 1, and I'm doing z as the resummation of order n of the z ai of kappa plus sigma 2 s theta n z bi of kappa. And I will take as an initial point, I'm taking just that sigma 1 is 1. And meaning I'm taking, so for if kappa, sorry, let me keep here sigma 1, sigma 2. So when kappa is just real and positive, I can take just sigma 1 equals 0 equals 1 and sigma 2 equals 0. Because then I get just the resummation of the ZAI. But once I start moving in the kappa plane, yeah, it's very important to note that I will cross Stokes line, particularly if I want to go from 0 to pi, I will cross a Stokes line and I will have to pick up the second saddle. And that will happen for, meaning the Stokes automorphism tells me how to do with this, meaning it's, I won't explain what sigma zero. Sigma zero is in the variable z here, but it doesn't matter. It will tell me how to jump, and the jump will happen at theta equals 2 pi over 3. So up to there, I can still keep sigma 1 equals 1, sigma 2 equals 0, but once I cross, sigma 2 will have a different value, and it will be given by this sigma. So what I wanted to show now is some of these resummations and the comparisons between these resummations, these different resummations. If I do that, so what you can see here in yellow is the actual plot of the AI function. Of course, I am keeping kappa, the value of kappa constant, the modulus, and I am only changing the angle, so the argument of kappa. And I'm going from zero, so this is at, it's real and positive at kappa, at argument zero, and at pi, it becomes again real, naturally, but in between, it can have complex values. Just for you to, sorry, just a second, for you to remember, this is, I just wanted to, this is just a plot of the AI function. It's so the negative direction is pi, the positive direction it's zero, and I want to be able to have both results. So here, in red, what you find are the Stokes lines. So Stokes lines happen at 2 pi over 3, and so 0 and 2 pi over 3 before pi, and these are anti-Stokes lines, where the result, if I included both saddles, would be oscillatory. So you can see that actually, so, and here what I'm doing is actually taking just the AI and doing an optimal truncation to the AI. If I choose this value of K, 1.7, you can actually easily see from this condition that the optimal truncation happens at n equals 3. So I can only add 3 terms. And if I do that and calculate the optimal truncated Z at I, AI, this is what I get. So it's very close, meaning fairly close, up to the point where I know I should have included now the second saddle, ZBI. And once I should include the second saddle, you can see that it kind of shoots off and does not follow closely the actual solution. So the question now is, what happens if instead of still doing optimal truncation, but instead of doing the ZAI only, I add the ZBI when I know I should add, and by knowing how much I should add it by using the Stokes automorphism. And you can see that now, instead of going away at the Stokes line, it actually follows fairly closely to the result. You can also ask, the question is, what if I didn't do optimal truncation? What if I added, instead of 3 terms, I added 6 terms? What would happen to the solution? This is what happens to the solution. So optimal truncation really has a meaning. It's really the best option that you can have to approximate your result if you're doing just truncation of the series. If you start adding more terms, it gets worse results. And this, sorry for the change of colors, so now this is actually doing a Kalborg-Padé resummation for different values. So it's a numerical resummation, it's an integral for each. So each one of these dots is doing an integration for a value of x, a particular value of kappa. You actually, so the blue line now is the exact value. What's here, a green line, is the original just AI solution. This is the optimal, in dashed, it's the optimal truncation of the trans series. And you can see that the actual Ekal-Borel-Padeh resummation follows exactly the exact solution. So it definitely is better than just doing a regular optimal truncation of the trans series. Naturally, because the only way to evaluate this integral, if you don't know the Borel transform, is by doing it numerically at each point. That's why the dots.
Sorry, if you had stopped with Padeh at a lower value, what
N equals six terms gives you exactly the same.
So already six.
It actually, it's yeah. Well, also because you only have two terms. So this is another option. What if I wanted to actually keep the argument fixed, but I wanted to change the value of k, of the modulus? And I can do that, and so I'm going to argument of k equals 5. Obviously, only having the AI will give me the wrong results because I already know that it hasn't followed the right solution. The optimal truncation of k, you can see that actually it follows fairly well. You can't see because it's on top. But when it starts getting to argument of k small, so remember that all the asymptotic series are for argument of k large, so that's where the best results are obtained. For argument of k small, you get worse results, definitely. And again, you have the correct solution at in blue, and in red, the dots of the numerical resummations. And you can see that definitely follows the exact solution.
You're saying argument of k or the modulus of k?
Modulus of k. I'm changing the modulus of k. I'm keeping the argument of k equals pi.
Okay.
Sorry, if I did said the opposite, I did a mistake. So these are the different resummations. This is just to show you the power of doing an actual Borel transform and then resumming back. Just as out of interest, something that Ricardo mentioned in the previous talk is the monodromy. You can, if you have the Stokes automorphism, I forgot to write here, you can actually, once you know how to do resummations, once you know how to do resummations, you can actually calculate the trans series at any point when you basically here you're keeping the modulus fixed and you're keeping on rotating. The idea is that if you go from 0 to 2 pi, you don't get the original solution because the monodromy, which is given by sigma 0, sigma pi, the monodromy of the quartic integral is actually 4. So you need to go 8 pi to get back. And this small drawing is just to help you with the number of times that we're going around the contour with the colors, and you can see that you start with the orange, it follows here, so goes back here, and so by the time we get to the green, where is it, the green? The green is here, so once the green finishes, you've gone 2 pi. Well, actually, 2 pi, exactly. The green finishes, it comes inside, and it goes to the blue, if I'm not mistaken. So you get the blue, it's here, so it continues, comes here, it's not blue, it's dark green. It keeps on going. You can continue back and forth, and you can see, like, after 4 pi, where in the values. This is an actually logarithmic version of the monodromy, just because otherwise you couldn't see all the detail. Because this, you can see that it's very small. But you can keep on seeing that you need to really go 8 pi to actually finally come back to the blue and to connect to the original solution. So this is just because of a comment that Ricardo made. What I really like to just tell you very, very quickly is, so Ricardo mentioned that what if instead of doing a linear problem, you did a non-linear problem? So what if I wanted to take log of z just to make it non-linear? And at the time, he wrote for you what non-linear equation log of z obeyed. Of course, this is very simple because it still inherits a lot of the structure from the partition function, which is very simple. But log of z obeys an equation 16x squared f double prime plus 16 squared f prime squared plus 32x minus 24 f prime plus 3 equals 0. So you can actually solve this equation. You can see that it also has two instanton actions. But now it will have all possible sectors, E minus L A over X, phi L of X, where phi L of X are also asymptotic series. And what I'm doing here, I can calculate this differential equation, I can calculate the coefficients of the phi L's, and I can calculate the Borel transforms and analyze the residues, because I can't do this in closed form anymore, so I need to actually analyze the Borel transforms and see where the poles are, where the singularities are. This is for phi 0 and phi 1, you can do this quite easily. The same ideas as before. Okay, and I kept two, I don't know why. This is just, sorry, it's just to scare everyone off, but it's the end of the lecture, so it's I guess it's okay. So because you have several sectors, now to calculate the Stokes automorphism, it's not enough to do the alien derivations as Ricardo mentioned the previous time. You're going to have a whole chain of possible alien derivatives acting. You can see that actually to go forward, you only have one motion. To go backwards, you're going to have all sorts of different motions. And the Stokes automorphism can be calculated directly from these motions. This is just a picture. I'm not going to mention anything extra from this. But these can actually be used. And now I'm sorry for the notation, because in fact, for the particular case of the quartic integral, you need a two-parameter transseries, but this is a detail. But in fact, you can actually do the analysis of the free energies for the leading and subleading factors, and you can see that the perturbative series, like by doing Cauchy theorem, will be directed by the one instanton series. You can calculate these from the values from the differential equation. And you can see, you know, by doing Richardson transforms, the exact same procedure. So here it's the subleading behavior. But this, the last slide that I wanted to show you is this one, which is, in fact, let me just write one more formula, and I'm done. That because you have a one parameter, in effect, a one parameter transseries with a lot of non-perturbative. So I wrote that the f of x will be given by, so let me write sigma x, will be given by basically, this is one parameter, but which is like a bound, it's the integral, it's the integration constant minus LA over X phi L. When you calculate the discontinuities, what will happen is that the discontinuities for, let me write, discontinuities of, for phi 0 specifically for the perturbative series, which is the F 0 0, will be given by a sum of well, the Stokes constant, basically, it shows up here, minus Ka over X phi K, where K is greater or equal than 1. So before I only had one term, now I have a whole series of them. And basically the leading behavior will be given by phi 0, which was what I showed, like the leading. But you're going to have 1 over 2 to the k behavior for the coefficients of phi 0, which is basically going to be ruled by, sorry, leading behavior is ruled by phi 1, is going to be ruled by phi 2. So basically what I'm saying is that, in fact, if you did proper resummation methods, you can actually have access to the phi 2. And these are the plots that show you, basically by doing a resummation, calculating all the coefficients, some coefficients, not all, because I don't have access to all, and plotting properly resummed perturbative series, I can have access to the coefficient of the two instanton series. And actually, we've done it three instanton series, four instanton series. So you can actually do this. And basically, by doing the large order behavior properly, you can have access to all of these phi k's. And it's been a... So in fact, when you do a resummation, there's a difference between the real and the imaginary part. The imaginary part is already 3 to the k, which will be given by the string, Simplon series, and et cetera. So, and yeah, that is it. Thank you.
Teach mathematically do arbitrary order, or have to like every when you go to the next order have to make some input by hand? Or
so what you need to know is in fact how to. So remember when I wrote the from the Cauchy theorem, I wrote that the Sn the Zn zeros had a contribution from the Zn1, and I said that that series was asymptotic, Zn1 plus 1 over n, Zn2. I need to, it's asymptotic, so I need to do a Kalborg-Padé resummation to that. It's a finite number of terms, I can do that resummation. Once it's there, that's a number, remove it, you have direct access. So, you, there's a, the input that is an asymptotic series, so you need to properly sum to get a number of the, out of that series, but you can do that, and then you have direct access. And then you do the same thing to this, to the series, remove, and you have access to the next one, and then on and then on.
Thank you.